And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You've probably already weighed in on the comments of the religious rights poster girl, ultra-conservative Ann Coulter, who in her new book, Godless, The Church of Liberalism, refers to the widows of the 9/11 tragedy as broads, harpies, grief paparazzis, and witches who enjoy reveling in their husband's death. The airwaves are hot. It's got everyone talking. But in Darfur today, the slaughter of innocent people goes on, hacked down by raiders from the north, the Janjaweed, who just kill, rape, and plunder. Funny, I didn't hear any stories about the outrageousness of that. I must speak out, and today we do, as we delve into the Darfur Diaries, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Tomorrow night, I'm off to see Al Gore's blockbuster An Inconvenient Truth, which is getting strong reviews from almost everyone. It's amazing how the media can shape public perception. Suddenly, global warming is cool, or hot, or catching fire, or something. I give a lot of credit to Al Gore for having the nerve to become a celebrity, with all the glamour and pomp afforded the arrival of Angelina Jolie's baby, which has already earned over $4 million in his first week on Earth. There'll be plenty of detractors soon about Al Gore, not me. I get it. He's way smart. He's a true alpha male. He understands that right now, it all comes down to the media. As we've learned all too painfully, you can sell almost anything if you control the media. And there's a backside to this story, and that is that unless something can capture the media, no matter how awful or how grim, it will go unnoticed. That's our story today. It's the story of Darfur. Darfur is beginning to get at least a little airplay. And yet I think that most people really don't know what it's all about. After all, the story used to be called the Sudanese Civil War. But civil wars, particularly in Africa, are, well, civil wars. They happen. And in the past, in various areas of Africa, in short periods of time, we hear of 30,000 or 90,000 or 150,000 dead and 250,000 people hacked to death. And, well, for starters, since 2003, 400,000 people have been summarily killed and millions driven from their homes. The thousands of lost boys who wandered about the Sudan for years, hoping to find a place to be, boys 4 and 7 and 9 and 11, thousands who wandered. So today, while the media focuses on stupid Ann Coulter, it ignores the story of Darfur. We won't. We'll hear about Darfur from Adam Shapiro, who, along with his co-producers, documented just a bit of the story in their documentary, Darfur Diaries. This show is dedicated to the people of the Sudan and Darfur, some of whom I've gotten to know from my work with the Sudanese refugees here in San Diego. Forget about Ann Coulter. Turn your awareness and apply your thoughts to Darfur. We go in depth with the Darfur Diaries following the news. So now, the news. Floods in southern China are responsible for the deaths of at least 46 people as torrential rains and hail forced over 120,000 people to leave their flood-ravaged homes. China has a long-standing history of devastating summer rains and typhoons, which annually destroy homes, crops, and buildings. Last year, over 2,500 people died from natural disasters in China. Japan is threatening to pull out of the IWC, the International Whaling Commission, on complaints that the world body which regulates whaling for all member nations is unrealistic in its stand concerning whaling. The IWC banned all whaling in 1986, but Japan began taking whales for what it termed scientific reasons the following year. The IWC is opposed to whaling as they say it is a cruel abuse of the world's largest creatures. Japan, on the other hand, claims that the eating of whale meat is a long-standing cultural tradition, and that certain whale species can tolerate annual hunting. Japan says that unless the IWC lifts the ban, Japan will form its own whaling organization with other whaling-friendly nations. Japan currently takes whales for what it terms scientific research. Nevertheless, much of the scientific whaling catch ends up as whale products, despite the fact that the traditions of eating raw whale meat and blubber is quickly losing its flavor amongst younger Japanese who now prefer hamburgers. California's Governor Schwarzenegger declared a state of emergency in 10 Northern California counties whose salmon catch this year appears to be dismal. The $9.2 million appropriated will be provided as loans to help fishermen and communities recover from the hardships imposed by a severely restricted salmon season. Many fishermen are attempting to keep in business by heading north to catch Dungeness crabs, but the journey is economically dangerous with gasoline prices holding above $3 per gallon. The salmon run along the Klamath has been dramatically impacted by what some see as poor river management and dams in the Klamath Basin. Congress and the UN are each struggling to solve an alarming decline in ocean fish species caused by overfishing. Last month, the UN warned that action was needed to set limits on fish catches to turn the trends towards increasingly greater numbers of species considered overfished. Fully one-fourth of fish species are overfished, and another 50% are being fished close to their sustainable levels. Bills introduced in the House and Senate are making attempts at setting up 8 regional councils to oversee offshore fishing. Such councils could set 10-year regulations on catches within their domain. Unfortunately, the bills do not contain regulatory enforcement to truly limit annual catches from one year to the next to compensate for overfished species. And here's my favorite story of the day. The Honorable Chief of Fiji's Makuata Province relied on an ancient hunting chant to unite the island's chiefs to set up a 23-mile protected aquatic zone in traditional fishing areas. The chant, which means literally, "Let's paint the day red with blood," was historically used to unite allies in battle. Using this war cry, he was able to entice all the neighboring chiefs to hear what he was proposing. They came to realize that to create marine protected areas is the way forward, he said, because you preserve the fish not only for our generation, but also for those not yet born. At first, Fijians resisted the plan, which barred fishing in some traditional areas, but when fish began coming closer to shore, those fears were quickly washed away. To which I say, bula bula. And that's the news. A few reminders. A great show is coming up next week when we take flight with Southwings, a volunteer alliance of pilots that are bringing new perspectives on what we often cannot see. And we just may have a very special guest. That's next week. There is no more significant story in any news than the one we are going to feature on today's show. We're going in depth with a sensitive look and analysis of what is occurring in Darfur, which is part of a larger saga of the Sudan. Please take the time to listen to someone who has been there and who now offers his insights in this special edition of the Wild Side News. The Wild Side News focuses a lot on nature and the environment. The environment is a very broad concept, and we cover all sorts of different areas of that, from, you know, talking about frog behavior and animal intelligence. We also talk about energy independence and the global warming and the issue of the future energy wars that are certainly happening. And it's one of the reasons I thought today would be a great time to really take a look at something that personally I find one of the most disturbing realities that I've ever experienced in my life. And this has to do with the stories that we're beginning to hear about coming from the Sudan and Darfur. And joining us now is Adam Shapiro, who, along with Aisha Bain, is a co-producer of a film that is now being aired all across the United States, and it's called Darfur Diaries. Adam, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks for having me.
Adam, tell us about Darfur Diaries, about the film, and we'll go into more depth on that later, but what is it, and how long is it, and also kind of what's happening with Darfur Diaries right now, and then we'll get into the story.
Well, Darfur Diaries is about an hour-long documentary film in which audiences will have the opportunity to hear from Darfurians about their life both now during the conflict and their lives. Both, we interview people who are internally displaced inside Darfur as well as people who are refugees who are in refugee camps in neighboring Chad. We met people from all walks of life, people who are school teachers, people who are older people, people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s who've endured much more than just this most recent conflict in Darfur. We met people who are fighting with one of the rebel groups against the government of Sudan. And we met people who are just trying to survive and figure out a way to continue living in this land. The film is now being shown, as you mentioned, across the United States at universities and community centers and wherever we can organize screenings. And what we hope to do with the film is inject into the public consciousness in this country and in the West more broadly the voices of the people who themselves are experiencing what some have called genocide and what certainly by any stretch of the imagination is some of the most extreme trauma that anybody can imagine.
Let's talk about why some people are beginning to awaken to the fact, some of us earlier than others, about why we consider this a genocide of our era, of our time.
Well, I think there's two components to it. There's one component, which is why has it taken so long for people to recognize this and to act on it, or why there has been a lack of action, particularly in light of, after our experience of Rwanda now more than a decade ago. And then the second aspect of it is all of the politics around calling this genocide, or calling anything genocide for that matter. On the first point, in terms of why it has taken so long, I think one of the reasons is that Darfur is an extremely remote area. It is, having been there and been in a number of different parts of northern Darfur, I can tell you that there isn't a whole lot of information technology, infrastructure, anything like that, where it would be easy for people to get word out. And so for a while, the only way people knew something was happening is because there were people streaming across the border from Darfur into Chad, and inside Chad, it took the response there by local communities to alert local officials, who then alerted the United Nations that something was going on and that, you know, refugees were arriving in Chad and needed assistance. There's the whole information side of it. And then secondly, the world has certainly been distracted the United States has been distracted over the last few years by what is going on in Iraq, what the U.S. is doing in that country, and other developments in other parts of the world that perhaps are touching more on America's interests certainly involving American lives in the case of Iraq. And Darfur and Sudan is sort of a far-off place. And then finally, I would say that most of the news that had come out of Sudan over the last two decades, and then certainly in 2000, 2001, up until 2003, had to do with the North-South Civil War in Sudan, the end to which was brought about by a negotiated peace agreement that was signed in 2003, in which the U.S. administration actually played a very important role in bringing about. And so many people sort of were confused. Well, there was a civil war, and it seemed to be this peace process that was underway. So how does Darfur fit into all of that? Does it fit into all of that? Is it not the same exact thing? Is it something different? And so there was a lot of confusion around that. As to the issue of genocide and whether it is or isn't, or how to debate it, whatnot, certainly I think that we can clearly identify a group of people in Darfur who have lost, who have been attacked, who have lost their ability to live in a particular area by virtue of this coordinated planned attack that is certainly being organized by a government. And so, you know, I think it certainly would qualify in terms of calling it a genocide. However, the groups, the parties that have called it a genocide to date, including the U.S. Congress and the U.S. administration, when former Secretary of State Colin Powell called it a genocide, they have failed to act. So when Congress passed a resolution calling the crisis in Darfur a genocide, it passed a non-binding resolution, which meant that it was just a statement. There was no action implied by that statement. Additionally, the U.S. administration hasn't felt bound at all by its declaration of this conflict as a genocide in terms of its dealing with the government of Sudan, and so subsequent to its declaration, to Secretary of State Powell's declaration of the genocide, the U.S. went on to host the top Sudanese intelligence official here in the United States for consultations about the war on terror, and didn't bother to mention at all what was brewing in Darfur and what the U.S. felt about it. So there's an element of politics involved here that have made it so far very easy for certain parties to call this a genocide without actually doing anything about it.
You know, actually, definitions only serve actually a limited purpose, because the story really is, it has to do with human beings. And the thing that troubles me in the story about Sudan and Darfur is that when civil war was unleashed and things began to get very intense, which began in 2003, the real truth of the matter is that 400,000 people since 2003 are dead as a result of absolutely willful, wanton, brutal slayings, primarily coming from the north, and we'll talk about that. And then in the process having this slaughter, orchestrated slaughter, perpetrated on the people of southern Sudan, people have just fled for their lives, literally for their lives, with absolutely nothing on their backs, just to try to survive. So the numbers that have been pouring into the refugee camps since 2003, estimates are close to 2 million people. This is a huge, huge human tragedy. And I personally can't understand how this could slip below the radar. I can't find any justification. I'm not challenging what you said, but just as a person and a U.S. citizen, it's extremely difficult for me to understand how this could so slip off the radar screen from the perspective of media, people in Congress, leadership, and it just hasn't been discussed at all. So if you could talk about, you know, you and there's a player in this, the co-director, Aisha Bain, who was a deputy director for the Center for the Prevention of Genocide, and she began to kind of tap into the story and began to try to get people to pay attention, and she ran across some sort of, I don't know if it was a brick wall or deaf ears or what the conflict was there, and this began to bother her. and somehow she expressed this to you, and you guys came up with an idea. We'll find out what happened to that good idea when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith. There's not much good to say about frustration and anger, that is, until it drives the human spirit to do the right thing. Many of us are hardwired to react when we sense injustice. It is, after all, the intellectual reflection of our animal instinct to protect our own pack. Our hackles raise, our attention focuses, and then, well, we see what happens when a quiet genocide touches the soul. When your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. It's often easy to refer to people who try to do the right thing as humanists. And in today's spin, humanists and humanitarians aren't necessarily what makes the evening news. But it just seems appropriate that we take just a moment to think what a humanist is. And I suppose, I guess, a lot of that depends on what your definition of humanness is. Why don't you talk about how what it is that happened to you too, and then where did it go from there?
Sure. Well, Aisha was, as you mentioned, the deputy director for the Center for Prevention of Genocide, and part of her job was to try to get the media, you know, everything from CNN and BBC on television to the New York Times and the Washington Post in print, and all the smaller media outlets, in both of those sort of mediums, as well as radio, interested in the story of, when she started hearing about it, about Darfur. And so she started contacting the media outlets and finding out, you know, what would it take to cover the story? Why aren't you guys covering the story? That sort of thing. And the answers she kept getting were things like, you know, we don't have the resources to send somebody over there because all of our resources are, you know, being spent on in Iraq at the moment. Or, if one of our competitors isn't covering the story, why should we? This is a story that Americans wouldn't be interested in. You know, there are all these different, excuses as to why they weren't covering the story. So Aisha was extremely frustrated, and I had just finished a documentary film on Iraq called About Baghdad, and I just decided, you know, in our discussions, we just decided, hey, if nobody else is going to be willing to go and cover it, let's just go ourselves and go with cameras and see what we can do. And Aisha had already started developing contacts by virtue of her work, so we knew we could, at the very least, we knew we could get to the refugee camps in Chad and interview people there, and hopefully, we didn't know for sure, but we figured we could try to work out a way to cross over the border and get actually into Darfur. And our mission at first wasn't necessarily to create a film. What we were hoping to do at the very, our modest goal was simply to come back with footage that we could then give to other people, to media outlets to use, and if it meant sort of helping craft a story to report on for them, as a way to sort of motivate the media to going, you know, to sending people out there to cover the stuff, so be it. But we didn't necessarily have the idea for film, and that came a little bit later, both in terms of once we were on the ground and talking to people and realizing that we could do a full-blown film, and then secondly, seeing that the media in the fall of 2004 did start to cover some aspect of the story, although not in very much depth and certainly not without the sensitivity that we thought was needed and that was required, both in terms of explaining the situation and also in terms of having people speak for themselves. A lot of the media coverage in the fall of 2004 and winter 2005 ended up being interviews with Western analysts of African politics and of Sudan in particular, and very little space, both in print and on TV, was given to Darfurians themselves. And that may have been because of language issues. Not a lot of people there speak English, so it does require a translator, but still we felt that was unacceptable, and so we decided to go ahead and make this film and to really, you know, just put it out there and get people interested and get people, and people are getting interested in Darfur, but giving them the opportunity to actually hear from Darfurians, and I can say, unfortunately, the marginalization of Darfurians and their voices has continued to some extent. I was just recently at the rally in Washington, D.C., held a couple of weeks ago, and I was surprised that of the speakers that they had on stage, there was not one from Darfur, although there are certainly a number of Darfurians here in the U.S. who are refugees who would have been happy to speak about what they experienced or what the news is that they're hearing from home. And instead on stage were all kinds of politicians, and George Clooney was there, and, you know, some others. But that's where our film really sits, and our mission really sat, was to put into consciousness the voices of Darfurians.
I think you make an extraordinarily good point in the sense, and it frustrates me too, that at these rallies it ends up being almost like a showcase for NGOs, all of whom are doing good, and celebrities and people of people who are concerned. But here's one of the things, and I'm actually working here in San Diego to help with the Sudanese refugees. And if I may say so, in the process of getting to know these people and being around them, this may sound like I have a unique form of prejudice, but I think they're an extremely intelligent, attractive, healthy, spirited, gracious, creative, well-spirited people. And unfortunately, somehow, when these stories develop, I think there's kind of a, I don't exactly know what it is that happens to the media and the American public and others, but it's almost like we write them off as if they are less than, what? Not, I don't want to say less than human, but not of the same value. And my experience, and this is what I want you to talk about too, is when you go and you're amongst the Sudanese and the Darfurians, these are a uniquely beautiful, wonderful people. Why don't you talk about your experiences?
We were very lucky to have been able to share in the time that we had with the Darfurians that we met, who were gracious. I mean, people who, as you mentioned earlier, who have literally had to flee for their lives and who have had the most severe kinds of trauma thrust upon them. Nonetheless, when we went to refugee camps, people, and these are people who are living, you know, on the margins of an environment that is inhospitable, to say the least. People would welcome us into their tents and immediately start to prepare from their rations that they had tea or whatever little food they can scrape together for us to treat us as guests the way they would treat people who were guests in their own homes, because culturally for them this is an important thing to do for anybody who is a guest to them. And so, you know, from little things like that to people who took the time out of, you know, in their destroyed villages inside Darfur, people who were displaced, who took the time to come away from the water well where they were collecting water to take back to their homes in the caves where they were hiding, to take the time away from doing that, to take us to their destroyed home and all of the trauma that's involved in seeing that again and explaining what life was like for them. People were so gracious with their time and with their willingness to speak. I mean, and part of it, I think, does have to do with the fact that they did feel as if nobody was paying attention to them. And here we were, you know, coming with a camera or a couple of cameras, and, you know, clearly we were from far away. and we were willing to listen, and we were willing to sit for as long as it took for somebody to tell a story and to talk about their experience, and we were interested in their culture and in their history and their lives, not just simply, this was the other part I think that's important, is that in making this film, we weren't just interested in these people as refugees or as victims. We were interested in them for who they were. And for these people, although they've come to prominence, and this is not just true of Darfurians, but people in many parts of the world, they've come to prominence in the consciousness of Americans or of Westerners or of the international community by virtue of them experiencing violence or trauma or whatnot, but yet that's not their identity. Their identity is something different. Their status as refugees or their status as victims is an alien status, is an alien identity for them. And so I think that's something that we were very sensitive to, and that was expressed in the kinds of questions we asked and the kinds of stories we were trying to get. And I think people responded to that, and that's part of the reason why we were able to sharing these experiences. We were taken one night inside Darfur, inside the destroyed village. There was a wedding, which was just utterly amazing, that here was this, you know, unique celebration of life in the midst of all this destruction. And the bride and groom insisted that we be there to not just to document it, we did bring our camera, but also to celebrate with them. That, you know, at some point they were like, okay, put down the camera, you must, you know, share with us, you must celebrate with us in our traditional way. And, in that sense, we were just so incredibly fortunate to have these kinds of experiences and to be able, hopefully, to share that with, a much, much wider audience.
The Sudan, is a relatively inhospitable region for many, and yet the Sudanese have been able to have existed there for thousands of years. By the year 2000, they were still maintaining their culture in villages. They're an agrarian-based, relatively self-sufficient, holistic people with family structures and communities and exchanging life between different villages. Give us a sense of what you perceived as their life before this radical disaster began to happen.
Well, in Darfur, I think you had primarily two communities, one of which was agrarian-based and farming, and the other of which was cattle herding or camel herding, more nomadic community. And the two have historically coexisted. I mean, there have always been times where there have been, disputes between different groups or different tribes or different families, and there have historically been ways for these groups to reconcile and to use traditional methods of reconciliation. Among the people that we met, people lived in villages comprised of huts that were made from the natural elements that were around them, whether they were small trees or mud in some cases. But what was clear is that the desert in this part of the world, in this part of Sudan, is definitely expanding. And, this is, I'm sure, attributable in part to global warming and to certain other just sort of natural developments. But what's clear is that this expansion of the desert is certainly drying up water resources and limiting the amount of land that is arable for both the farmers and for the herders. And so this is the environmental aspect of this has certainly contributed to some of the tensions in the region overall. But this doesn't explain, of course, why there are 400,000 people who've been killed and 2 million made refugees and millions of others made homeless. Rather, this points to the larger issue, which is how are we globally treating the environment, and this is one of the sort of local ramifications of the overall processes of global warming, and should be, if in addition to all of the other reasons for concern about Darfur, it should also be a big warning light to those of us in the West and industrialized countries that the effects of how we are treating the environment have incredible impacts for people who are living in other parts of the world, including in this area of Darfur that people have scratched a living from and found a way to survive and thrive for thousands of years and are now facing, in addition to violence, they're also facing a big challenge to their traditional livelihood.
Right. A good point. That's exactly right, that what we live our lives, we hear about global warming, but for people like that who, you've stated the case really very well, they've been able to maintain, even in these inhospitable situations, and global warming is now tipping that and creating more difficulties. Let's now take a look a little bit at Sudan, because I've tried to paint a picture of the southern Sudanese, who are, in this case, the people being ravaged. And the attacks are well orchestrated and coming from northern Sudan. Help us understand what that's about.
Well, actually, in the case of Darfur, it's a little bit, it's not quite the same as what you're pointing to is more like a historical conflict between north and south. In Darfur, which is more the western part of the country, what's happened is that the government, which is based in the north and which the elite of the country, the ruling elite, comes from just a couple of tribes and villages in the north of the country. What they've done is sought an alliance with a local militia, local tribal groups in Darfur, that are in the Darfur region, and have sought to empower those groups versus other groups. And the other groups being people from the Zagawa, the Fur, the Masalit, and some of the other smaller tribal groups. And they've used this militia in Darfur, which are called the Janjaweed, to attack and to basically, carry out raids against civilian villages. The government isn't sort of sitting back, though, and not taking a role. In fact, the government is taking a primary role, both in terms of arming the militias and giving them cover, but also in attacking. I mean, a lot of the initial attacks against villages and against civilian areas were actually conducted by what are called Antonov aircraft, which are huge bombing aircraft that are owned by the and used by the Sudanese military, and also by MiG fighter jets, who have been used, as well as attack helicopters. So there's been an aerial component to the assault against civilians and against villages in Darfur that is wholly the government, because no militia in Sudan has aerial weaponry or aerial power whatsoever. The militias that are empowered are attacking on horseback or on camelback and are, you know, conducting raids and committing atrocities against civilians. And in response to that, rebel groups have formed, both in terms of trying to defend the people of Darfur, but also to try to fight against the government in an attempt to remove the government from power, recognizing that this government has conducted this campaign and similar campaigns against the southern Sudanese, against people of the Nuba Mountains region in Sudan, people in the Kordofan region of Sudan. Increasingly now there are attacks against people in the eastern part of the country along the border with Eritrea, an area where people known as the Rashidiya and the Beja people live. And so what's increasingly recognizable today and for the last 20, 30 years is that this regime, which is based among a small elite in the north, is seeking to control the whole country, all of its resources, and marginalizing others, and employing various militia groups all over the country and to carry out attacks. In response, the Darfurian rebel groups, as well as other rebel groups throughout the country, are starting to recognize that each of their regional fights is part of a larger nationwide fight, and that includes the Southern Sudanese, the SPLA, the Southern Sudan People's Liberation Army, which signed the peace agreement, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2003, nonetheless is starting to recognize that that peace agreement is extremely fragile and most likely won't be implemented in the long term, and so they may need to pick up arms again as a means of removing this government from power and establishing a more representative government for all of Sudan.
Easier said than done. As our nation fights its version of its global war on terror, committing billions of dollars in resources, the terror of attack continues unabated amongst the people of the Sudan and Darfur. Is there hope for a resolution? We find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith. What possible reason could there be for such inhumanity? And why is such madness permitted to continue despite the calls for action? There are unlimited excuses and a near total lack of will. Why? It seems the disasters of our time, despite our drive for ultra-technological wizardry that drives the global good news, keep asserting their truth. Stay tuned. The Darfur Diaries continue with Adam Shapiro. One of the components that people claim is driving this, and I would appreciate your perspective on this, is that there is a fairly strong ethnic difference between what is referred to as the Northern Sudan and Southern Sudan and Darfur. And some people would say that the Northern Sudan is more reflective of the Arab and Muslim elements, then the southern Sudanese and people in Darfur are more associated with Christian and animist traditions. Help us understand that. Give me your perspective.
Well, there certainly are differences among the different tribes and peoples of Sudan. There are more than 60 tribal groupings, and among the 60 you find there are linguistic differences, there are what could be called ethnic differences, what could be called certainly religious differences. However, the fight, for instance, historically between the North and the South was never about religion per se. It was about, and if you ask, John Goering, unfortunately he was passed away, but the people who've taken Salva Kiir, for instance, who took his place, he would tell you the fight was never about religion. The government of Sudan was using religion, depicting the conflict as a Muslim versus Christian battle, as a way of mobilizing support for itself. So it was looking to mobilize support among Muslims in Sudan to fight against the southerners, and it was using it internationally to seek support from fellow Muslim nations to support the government of Sudan in its campaign against the South. And in Darfur, you can't use the Muslim-Christian dichotomy because everybody in Darfur is Muslim. So instead, what's been used by the government is the notion that this is an Arab versus African conflict. And so trying to depict the tribes in Darfur who are the ones who have primarily been attacked as African, and the government and its affiliated militias as Arab. And so and that has been used to try to mobilize support in the north of Sudan among people who typically refer to themselves as Arab, as well as in the Arab world to try to secure support from Arab countries for the regime. However, if you ask the people in Darfur, as we did, what do you consider yourself? Are you African? Are you Arab? What's the difference? They'll tell you, look, we speak Arabic, so therefore we are Arabs, and it's true. I mean, historically, being an Arab never had anything to do with, or at least not after the 19th century, had anything to do with where you were from or what you were ethnically or racially. Being Arab, according to the Arab Nationalist Movement, had to do with whether or not you spoke the Arabic language, and as such, it was an inclusive effort at nationalism to include Christians, Muslims, Jews, even Druze and other religious groups, as well as ethnic groups, including Berbers and African, African tribesmen in Sudan and in Mauritania and elsewhere. To link them together with people from the Arabian Peninsula, from Iraq, from Syria, from Lebanon, all of these places in one large sort of nationalist linguistic grouping. Additionally, the people in Darfur will tell you, look, the people who are in the north of our country all live in Africa, and we are all Africans, and there's no difference between us racially or ethnically, and you'll find that as well in the north. If you talk to people in Khartoum, they'll tell you that, look, we are all African, we are all Arab because we speak the same language. And so this notion that there's a difference is something that's been created for political consumption and as a means of mobilizing one against the other. And really it's being used by the government to generate support for itself.
But what is the motivation of that government that is spinning all of these agendas? Why is this happening?
Well, they are a very small. The government represents a very small ruling elite, and it is the current rulers came to power by virtue of military coup in 1989, and so their sources of support are a few large families that are home in the northern part of the country, as well as some elements of the military. In order for them to hold on to power, in order for them to maintain their tight grip of control over the resources of the country, and there are increasingly, it's become known that there's greater oil reserves in Sudan than were previously thought, so there are a decent amount of economic resources there. In order for this regime to hold on to power, it needs to keep others out of sharing that power. Because in the end, this regime, this ruling elite, is a minority, and a very small minority in the country. And so if other groups were to share power, if other regions were to share power, there would be much less power resources available for this ruling elite, and it's not ready to give up power. It's not ready to share with others. And so the only way for it to maintain its grip on power is to keep the country in a form of chaos. And the way it's done that is by promoting these divisions within the country, by trying to prevent groups from unifying with each other, both regional groups and tribal groups from unifying with each other, and organizing to form a more representative government that would represent both the regional characteristics of the country as well as tribal and religious characteristics of the country.
So where are they gaining their support from? Who is supporting the government in Khartoum?
Well, you have the support certainly from other Arab governments who bought into this sort of Arab-African dichotomy. And then, interestingly, simultaneously, you also have support from the African Union, which would seem to be, on the face of it, somewhat bizarre, because they're playing off their own identity. The government is playing off its own identity as an Arab government, not as an African government. And yet, it is a player in the African Union. It is an African government. And like many other African governments, is not democratically elected, and so it can gain some support and solidarity from other regimes on the continent. And then beyond that, certainly China and Russia have extensive investments and interest in the country, both for its oil as well as military contracts, export of various products and whatnot. So, you know, there are, beyond just simply the Arab and African worlds, supports for this regime in the international community. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, the United States, although it still considers Sudan to be, it's a country that's still on the list of terror-supporting countries, also simultaneously is considered a partner in the war on terror by sharing intelligence and information that it has gathered. It's well known by now that Osama bin Laden found home in Sudan up until 1996. And so, you know, there are some in the U.S. government who value the Sudanese government's ability to provide information with regards to Al-Qaeda or other, you know, groups that it's interested in.
Now, there are some sort of breaking developments that we keep hearing about these days. Suddenly, Darfur is on the radar screen, and the United Nations is becoming involved. The United States is becoming involved. What do you see, what are you hearing right now, and what do you think is the projection for the future here, let's say in the next number of months?
Well, there was recently this peace agreement signed in Abuja that was signed by the government of Sudan as well as one of the rebel factions. A number of the other rebel factions have actually rejected the deal, saying that it is insufficient to generate real peace in Darfur, and have made a good case as to why that is. The UN, as part of this deal, it got wrapped into the deal, but separately, the UN was pushing for deploying a peacekeeping force in Darfur to replace the African Union mission that is there just simply as observers. But it's very unclear as to what exactly this UN force would look like. The U.S. has already said it will not send troops to Sudan. There's a great reluctance on the part of European powers at this point, who are already well deployed in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places, like the French, for instance, are deployed in Ivory Coast. The British are deployed in Sierra Leone and Liberia, I believe. So there's not many troops available if we're talking about Western countries or if we're talking about these European countries and the United States. And so the question then remains, well, where will troops come from? The largest UN mission is currently in the Congo right next door and certainly has its significant problems there in terms of maintaining numbers of peacekeeping forces, as well as in terms of what those peacekeeping forces are doing. There's actually been a number of crimes committed by those peacekeeping forces on the ground, including sex trafficking and drug running and a number of things like that. So there's actually great concern over what kind of UN forces could be, how robust it would be, and then finally, the government of Sudan so far has still not agreed to actually having a UN force on the ground. So all of that is still up in the air, and it's not quite certain when or if this might move forward.
So the bottom line, sort of, is the fact that the, in essence, nothing effective is going to happen in the near future. And I, as, unless I'm mistaken, I believe the slaughtering still continues. And am I right about that?
Yeah, indeed. Since the peace agreement has been signed, Janjaweed militias have been conducting a number of raids and attacks. Additionally, the one rebel faction that did sign on to the agreement has actually conducted attacks against representatives and civilians who are followers of the other rebel faction. So it's becoming, it was already a big mess politically, and also, of course, you know, the civilians are suffering all kinds of horrors, and now it just seems to be getting even worse.
If you could wave that magic wand, what would you recommend?
Well, somebody needs, the government of Sudan needs to be held accountable, and that ultimately is what it comes down to. The government of Sudan escaped accountability for the war it conducted against the people of the South for over 30 years by virtue of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And in fact, it was a signatory to the agreement and was treated to all kinds of kudos by the international community for signing the agreement, ending a war in which over a million people, well over a million people, were killed. All kinds of atrocities were committed, and basically nobody was held accountable for those atrocities. So the government has a track record. It has a track record of escaping any sort of accountability or responsibility for its actions, and this is at heart the problem in Sudan. And so unless the international community is willing to, including the African Union and including the Arab League, are willing to deal with this regime as a criminal regime, which it really is, and looking at the country as a whole, well, these problems will persist, if not in Darfur, then in another region of the country. And so this is where I think the fault lines are. And I don't know if there is a magic wand, but certainly, dealing with this regime in an honest and direct way is one place to start.
Well, Adam Shapira, you, along with Aisha Bain and Jane Marlowe, co-produced a film that really takes a look at this on a very personal level, which is called Darfur Diaries. When people want to find out about where this may be showing, or if they wish to schedule a showing, what's the best way for them to contact you and make that happen?
All the information is available on our website, which is www.darfurdiaries.org. And on there is information about the film, about the places we went to, and how to schedule a screening and to get in touch with us.
Well, I wish we had about three more hours, but our time is up. Adam Shapira, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you for having me again.
Every day, in various areas of our earth, refugees are arriving from the ravaging mysteries of inhumanity. You can help by looking in your own communities and giving whatever you have to assist in rehumanizing the gracious people of the Sudan. And at the same time, waste not a moment more. Write, talk, demand, raise your voice, maybe raise your fist at the towers of power to take back our soul of a nation. Because every day that passes finds us slipping deeper and deeper to sleep, into a hypnotizing morass of a fractured spirit. Many would say, it cannot be by design, no. And therefore we're left with this. We can blame no one but ourselves. Awaken. Rise up. Take back our reason. Don't wait a moment longer. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth speaks out here on the Wild Side News.